This is the First Time Podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us
and conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures.
Hello there, Catherine Collette.
Hi. I've been thinking about you because I know that you have had COVID in the household.
We have had COVID in the household, and I cannot tell you, last night, Mum and Dad dropped around dinner. They normally have the kids on a Thursday, and the kids actually were both negative yesterday, but Mum and Dad are traveling, you know, soon. And I said, no, don't, we're not doing that. But they dropped around dinner, and it was glorious and delightful because I'd forgotten about the fact that what lockdown felt like, in one sense, was just doing dishes and making food.
Very
and that's
true.
Basically what I've Very done true. For the past week. We had everyone at home, even though there's two. I'm, touch wood, still fine and not testing positive.
But because you have nothing immediately pressing that you really want to go to.
Yeah, potentially.
That is the sole reason.
Right? But I did. I was immediately sucked back. I've been so grumpy and unable to, like, get tasks done. I wrote about it for the newsletter this week because I was just like, this is bizarre. This is bizarre how my body is reacting as though we are in the middle of 2020.
Do you get the nice bit? Because there was a nice bit to that early stage lockdown of slowness. But I guess you didn't have COVID, so you had no
justification have COVID, but I
to
did
kind of retreat.
A couple of people who I was whinging to in various messages said, like, just take the pressure off yourself. Like, so I have, you know, binge watch some things with the kids.
Yeah,
I have done slow cooking, you know, with the kids. But wow, it's something else. And also it's so bizarre because it's back to, remember that crazy stage? And I remember us talking about it on the podcast where you had to make the decisions yourself.
Yeah.
Like the beauty of when everything went to real shit and when we're in lockdown and there were rules and the things was that you didn't have to make any of those decisions.
Yeah.
But this feels like back to that weird period where people were like, oh, I'm actually going to take my kids out of school or I'm not going to come to this thing because there's no bloody rules anymore. I had to Google what the rules were.
Yeah.
And then even they're so loose, like, oh, yeah, well, you can send your kids back to school or, yeah, you can do that thing.
If you've got no symptoms, do you have to wear a mask? Like, or can you just go about life?
There's still like regulations. Yeah, you're advised to, but because there's not a close contact official, there is.
Yeah.
Like if you're living in the house and I've worn a mask when I've gone out and I haven't gone to gym, you know, I went back this morning, but I stayed away and all of those things. But it just feels like I don't want the responsibility again, although I also don't want to go back into lockdown. Anyway, it's been very weird. And also because, of course, I've written about it in the novel. There's a section that is set in an aged care residence during lockdown in 2020. And so it felt, and because I've been editing and rereading those sections, it just felt like a strange week. Anyway, we're nearly all out of it. So that's good, right?
You'll be in the world, still not in the world, but virtual world. Instagram, I saw a pretty amazing post from you.
Oh, my goodness. That was so exciting. So I got to do the cover reveal yesterday, which
I have
been.
It was a good reveal too. Like it was a countdown-y type.
Yeah,
it's good.
It's a beautiful video. Brad Graham, who is a digital whiz at Simon & Schuster, made it. And I had been waiting on it because I think I said to you or in another episode, like, come on already. I'm seeing cover reveals for October. Like, I want my book out in the world. I can't talk about it. But it was so exciting to see it. And then, honestly, just the delight. It feels like it's the first real moment. Like, they can't take it back now. You know how when you publish the book, you still assume at any stage that the publisher's going to go, oh, actually, we made a mistake. We're not going to publish your book at all. And then you feel like, okay, cover reveal that it's real now. It's real.
So, it's a straightforward moment too, in that all they can do is see the cover and you didn't make the cover.
I didn't make the cover. Exactly. It's still all the buzzy bit where people are excited and yet no one outside of the amazing people who've done endorsements for me, no one's read it. So yeah. It's like, great. It's a really, yeah, it's fun. It's a nice moment, but it is good to tick
sitting
it off.
On my bedside table and has been sitting on my bedside table, but I'm timing it to when I can actually talk to you.
Yeah, exactly.
It's taunting me.
We have to time these things particularly well with the reading. I've actually started doing my piles. I don't know how you do them, but the piles in here, I've now got by time, like by when I have to read them by.
Yeah.
And I put them as close to the interview or the event as possible. Some I'll read twice, so that I read it once and then I'll read it again closer.
Do you skim really? It.
Well, skim.
For a skim full closer. Length interview more.
Yeah. Or, yeah, mm.
Or,
an or
for
event,
an event.
Or a launch or something like that. Yeah. But, yeah, I have literally arranged them by time. It's very funny.
Yeah. Yes. Well, mine are more zoned. Like by the bed is prime location. But then, you know, floor of the study is second. And then if shelf is like a big, I've got time.
But then also if the ones by the bed, if you get like, once you've got kind of six or seven there, then what happens? You've got some at the bottom. It's crazy. It's very crazy. On reading things, you and I have recently talked about waiting. And the waiting period, because you've recently been through a rather intense waiting period. And I read a fantastic article this week from Madeline Dorr, who you know I love. And
it's in her newsletter.
Yes, her newsletter on things. It's such a good newsletter. I've recently fully subscribed to it. And this week's article was called On Waiting for Things. And it's so good. I think for you and I who've recently done waiting, but for anyone in publishing, there are, and in the writing world, like there's so many of those intense moments of waiting for feedback and waiting on submission and then waiting just for timelines in publishing. But what I thought was so powerful about her article, and I'm just going to read out a short section, is the way that she reframes waiting. So this is what she says. There have been times that I've sat in the waiting room of someone else's life, waiting for a reply, waiting for their decision, waiting for them to arrive. During such times, I've been living on someone else's time, and eventually what has eroded is a firm grasp on my own. Such experiences have taught me the subtle differences between the waiting we need to bring patience to and the waiting we need to be wary of losing ourselves to. And I thought that was so great, because so often, I mean, the advice, right, is to do something else when you're in a waiting period, like try to forget. But it's incredibly hard. And I think the context for this article, she hasn't said specifically what she's waiting on, but something that could really change things. And it's really hard because you can't then imagine yourself into the future past the letter, the email, the job, the, you know, medical appointment, whatever it is, because it's going to have such a big impact. But I thought noticing that it is when we're waiting on someone else and their decision, and what that does to ourselves, that's a good way to kind of reframe it in my head.
I think phones and the internet are a terrible contributor in the current day to the excruciatingness of waiting, because you have this compulsive refresh kind of approach, which sort of makes it worse. Like it would be easier in some ways if you were just waiting for a letter or waiting for something.
Yes. Yes. You know, yes, because so maybe our patience mental. Is also just has deteriorated so rapidly that we're so used to speed now. We're so used to instantaneous that the idea of being patient and patiently waiting for something is kind of gone from us. But yeah, who knows? Distraction, you know, doing a bit of gardening. I don't know.
It's
throwing
really
yourself
hard.
Into
it's
something
hard
else.
When it feels like a turning point too, because there are sometimes things that you can do beyond the waiting that are beneficial, but it can be hard to get the thing you're waiting about, like the tail of it, out of your head.
It's a really good article. She also says that in those waiting periods, what's very good is that we learn what we truly want. And I think that's a very point. You know, and we, and you can do something with that too, because if it, well, if this thing that I'm waiting on doesn't happen, then I already know that this thing is what I really want. So let's find another pathway to it. But highly, highly recommend. I think she's so wise.
That's such
and smart.
A good point, actually.
What have you been reading, doing?
Now, I have a bigger listening one, but in terms of reading, very short recommend. I read an article about widows in the Good Weekend recently. Ooh. It was last week's Good Weekend. It was called Till Death Do Us Part by Fenella Souter. It was so interesting. It interviews widows of different ages and talks about the experience of being a widow. And kind of this idea that the loss of a long-term partner is something that a lot of people will experience, probably more women than men, but it's really something that gets no airtime or very, very little airtime, particularly in that kind of longitudinal sense. Like you see the death of a partner, but you see it sort of in that first initial period. Just a really fascinating, lovely, moving article. I'll link in show notes. But there was one bit about it was just a tiny thing, which is not necessarily reflective of the whole article at all. But one thing that they mention in the article is the comfort of a handwritten letter as opposed to a text message, which on the surface you can say, oh, yeah, that'd be much nicer. But relating that to the idea that a handwritten letter has no onus of response, whereas a text message comes with an obligation, which I think is something I had never considered, but a thing I will definitely remember.
That's really nice. I like
that.
Yeah,
isn't it? Yeah.
I like it when there is hard and fast advice in those kind of situations from someone with the lived experience that says, this is useful for you to do or say. This is not useful for you to do or say in this situation. I like being able to follow those things.
Yeah, super simple. Handwritten letter. Love it.
Let me ask, do you still read The Good Weekend in physical form or do you read it online?
Well, it was sent to me, actually. My mum sent it to me. So we got the weekend papers for a long time, the physical paper, but I don't anymore.
I know, neither do I.
And then we got the Saturday paper even physically delivered, which I love the Saturday paper, but too heavy for a weekend.
Like, yeah.
Quite heavy. Then I think I should do the monthly, but probably monthly is better online. I don't know.
The thing that I realize is that I'm missing is that, you know, I subscribed to the Saturday paper. I subscribed to lots of them online, but I never get to the articles. Like sometimes I'm like, oh yes, great. I've got a subscription. I can read that thing that everyone's talking about. But what I miss about the Saturday morning of having all the papers laid out and looking at them is that it was actually quite a stop quiet time. Like I'm going to actually have the second cup of coffee and read through this.
It
and
was
even
lovely.
Yeah.
And
even
and surprising
to see that. Yes.
Like,
whereas if you're on your phone reading, like it's not like you've got a different face or a t-shirt that says, I'm actually reading something very worthwhile and I'm not just scrolling here to the kids. You know, like it was kind of a moment. Yeah. Anyway, maybe I'll go back to the paper. But also the reason that I stopped in the end was because it's a massive amount of paper that was mostly ads in there.
It's a lot thinner. I think you'll find these days.
And a
pretty
lot
thin.
A lot thinner. Oh, story about the death of the media another time.
I agree with you though. I used to love that. Like that sort of breakfast spent reading the paper on the weekend was a lovely experience. And you sort of started, I remember doing it even in my teens. Like it was sort of a symbol of growing up in some ways.
Yeah, that you could do it. Although having said that now, like we are more likely to be hustling, finding basketball shoes, footy boots, you know, all the things. So maybe it is also a time thing. I have been reading on a theme this week. I've read two memoirs this week, which I read both very swiftly. And even though they're very, very different, just very readable, like totally enthralled by the reading. So the first is by Alexandra Collier, Inconceivable. Have you read it yet?
No, she's sending it to me.
Yeah. Oh, it's so good. So it's people will have heard about it. It's Ellie's memoir of solo motherhood. She wants to have a baby, and this book takes us from her split with her you know, longish term partner in New York through the kind of roller coaster of dating to her decision to try IVF as a solo mother and then to the birth and early years of motherhood. I didn't really realize this before, but Ellie is a playwright and a screenwriter, and you can tell, like, the writing is so good. It flies along. You're deeply in it. Great voice, great sense of voice. But the book is also very nuanced, very complicated. She goes into, you know, some kind of bigger research stuff, like almost journalistically, into ideas about the history of IVF and some of the legislation around it, particularly for solo women and same-sex couples, and things like that. But also it's just deeply, deeply personal. It really reminded me when I was reading it of reading Sheila Hetty's Motherhood. I don't know if you read that a few years back, which is fictionalized, I seem to remember, but it reads like a memoir. And the way that that book kind of just came from such a different perspective to what I had had through my life about parenting and about the decisions and the choices you make about becoming a parent. And I think that Ellie's book is just the timing. Anyone could read it. You don't have to be thinking about becoming a parent. You don't have to be a parent. Just the way that it reframes how you could be a family, have a family, become part of a community. Yeah, so good. So, so good.
Ooh, I love highly, that. Great. Highly recommend.
And the other one is called The Swift Dark Tide. It's by Katja Ariel. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I actually met Katja at an event recently, and she handed me a copy of the book, and then it arrived in the post the next day. And I was like, well, that's the double whammy I need to say, okay, I'm going to pick this one up. It is, as the blurb describes it, it's part memoir, part love letter. And it traces this period in Katja's life when, in the middle of her very happy hetero marriage, she falls in love with another woman. So it tells that story. And it's also a kind of story of the generations of women in her own family, particularly her mother and her grandmother's lives in Odessa, where they come from. And this ongoing kind of theme of women and desire and hunger, and this phrase she uses a lot, which is like the animal in all of us. It is so, so, so beautifully written. She's an editor and a poet by trade, I believe. And it's kind of in fragments, so quite a small book. The writing is exquisite, dense in parts, so it's not a quick read, but just very, very beautiful. And again, this kind of reframing and very complicated, nuanced look at how we do family, how we do relationships, the cultural and social expectations on us, how that works, how it doesn't work. Highly recommend. Very, very good. It's only out recently, and it's through Gazebo Press, I believe. But yes, very good recommendations from me.
I just realized I have that sitting on my desk.
There you go.
I'm going to shuffle it into the bedroom.
Shuffle it into the bedroom list. Okay, tell me, you've got a big one for listening. Tell me, what is listening?
I do have a big one for listening. So this was sent through by Cassie Hammer, who is a brilliantly funny author herself. She wrote After the Party, Truth About Faking It. She recommended a podcast called You're Welcome by Hilary Rushford Coyler. Coyler, I'm going to say it. Have you heard of Hilary Rushford Coyler?
I have not. Please tell me everything.
Well, I didn't know a lot about her. Really what Cassie has recommended is these three particular episodes, which I'll come to, but a little bit about Hilary. She's a personal stylist, life coach. She founded the Dean Street Society, which was something I had heard of, but was also not very familiar with. So their thing is, their motto is, we explore what makes women feel beautiful and how to create a beautiful life without burning out. So Hilary's work is in this kind of nexus of life coach, self-improvement, feminism, but also beauty. They do various courses. There's a journal. She mentions in the podcast she employs multiple people. I think she needs to earn five figures a week to keep the business alive. So it's a pretty successful business.
Yeah, wow.
She's got on her personal Insta She's got 200,000 plus followers. She's obviously got the podcast. I think the flavor of the pod is let your light shine kind of thing. But recently she did a three-part series that's been super duper popular. This is how she describes the three-part series. I decided to write a book. I had no idea it would cost me, it would nearly cost me everything. Great agent, goes to auction, top five publisher, 2 years and two lawyers later, I fought to tell the truth about what happened to me in this three-part series.
Oh my goodness.
It's that is the perfect expression for it. It is full on. So it's three very long episodes. If you do choose to listen, I feel like I have to say that she has had a bad publishing / non-publishing experience. She's very upset about it. There is a lot of crying. So like
crying
a lot.
In the podcast.
A lot of crying.
Does she talk to someone else or is it just like?
It's just solo? Her. Yes.
Whoa, that's
and so
intense.
It's a lot. I feel like it's my message around that is absolutely fine to cry. Obviously, we all cry.
Yeah.
But I feel like I would say it's worth persevering. Maybe you don't need to listen to the first episode. The first episode could be considered an hour of throat clearing.
Okay.
But the frame is certainly initially is that she wants to be able to tell people what's happened to her and it's part of her healing. So that out the way, that's not a negative. That's just part of it. Okay. Yeah. So high level things. She has this business. She has a sizable Instagram following. She puts together a 75 page book proposal where I'm using specific numbers. It's just that she uses the specific numbers and repeats them. She put together a 25. I really like her as well.
Yeah.
She put together a 75 page book proposal. It's got sample chapters of the book. Same space as the business. It also has this kind of social justice element to it, which is interesting. So it's not just about beauty and the patriarchy. It also looks at things like race. So sounds quite interesting. She's white. That's not really a big part of it, but sort of semi-relevant. She does the book proposal. She gets an agent, a great agent. The book goes to auction. She gets a big advance and things start sort of rolling. So she has an editor at this big five publisher. The editor's quite hands off from the very beginning. So the editor says that the company says, I have no idea what company this is, says that she has to actually pay another editor that the company will pick to do the editing work. So it's five figures she has to pay this other person.
That's unusual.
It's unusual. It's never been mentioned in the bidding process. Agent is like, yeah, that's pretty normal. That's normal. Hillary also gets told she has to pay for an illustrator after a couple of months, also never been mentioned. And so agent is like, oh yeah, that's pretty normal. So she sort of is pretty blind to the process. She comes from this small business background. And that's what's so fascinating about it is that she has this small business perspective and you can see all the way through how her perspective, which is actually quite reasonable in many ways, is inevitable. It's like a unbreakable wall and an unstoppable wall. They're like they cannot both survive. So she has expectations that are from this point of view, and then the publishing industry just doesn't work that way. So things like because she has this business and she's done the book proposal, but she hasn't written the book, she has to take time away from the business to write. And so she talks you through the mathematics of this is how much the business would make. The book advance, which is quite sizable, actually is only 1 month's worth of cost in the business. She has a lot of requirements going in around, okay, I can't have the book come out at this time of year in the month of June because I've got a launch and the launch is like half the earnings of our business. So that month's out. And so she has a few requirements which have not been passed on to the publisher. And so when the publisher starts fiddling with saying, oh, actually, we've got to move it to this date, we've got to move it to that date, Hillary is understandably upset, but then you kind of have this counter view of that's kind of public. It just is so fascinating because of these dual views. You can kind of see both sides. So
the
a number
train
of
wreck
things
that's about to happen.
Oh, it's a train wreck. It's a train wreck. And so there are a number of things that objectively you're like, oh, that's not great. Like that shouldn't have happened. So she does definitely objectively have a bad experience alongside some stuff around expectations. So she sends the book to she's been working with this editor she's been paying. She sends the book to the in-house editor. She's advised by her agent while the book is with the in-house editor to keep working on it and keep going. But what ends up happening is there are two versions of the book.
God. I'm like having a breakdown just listening to you say this. I don't think I can listen to it.
So then when the in-house editor comes back and has edits, Hillary's like, oh, but I've got this other version. And so things start to go wrong there. The original editor ends up leaving the company, which means the book is orphaned. Mm-hmm. Orphaning a book is not a great thing. What that means is the editor that bought the book has left. The book goes to another editor. The next editor that's in-house doesn't really like the book, is talking to these two versions. And Hillary's like, I'm going to have to take 3 weeks off work, which is a big thing because of the business. Take 3 weeks off work to merge the versions. I'm not sure what to do. In any case, it doesn't matter because the next editor leaves. Then there's a third editor who has not even a lot of interactions, but a couple of challenging interactions. Then the third editor sends an email that is like brutally harsh. Starts out by saying, I agree with everything the other editors have said. And Hillary's like, what have they said? No one's ever said anything to me. The email kind of continues, this book is terrible. The only way it could ever, maybe, possibly be salvaged is if you pay someone to rewrite it.
Oh, my God.
So essentially it would need to be ghost written. So it just, that is the point at which it completely falls apart. They have, I think, like, it's actually, the consequence for her is kind of terrible because I think because of the structure of their finance and the way in which she has approached it, you know, which you can do it this way, is to take complete time off work and replace full-time work with full-time writing. They were going to buy a house. They can't buy a house. She nearly ends up losing. Yeah, horrendous.
My heart rate is through the roof right now.
It's so compelling. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, what are your takeaways from listening to this? What does one take from it?
I don't know. It's fascinating, absolutely fascinating to listen to because of this outsider perspective. One thing it did remind me of was that, which I hadn't ever really thought about it because I'm quite removed from it in many ways, was that I think my book, it was in the States, The Helpline, was essentially orphaned. So it had, I had this similar experience in a very different way, in that it went to auction, it was purchased by the head of an imprint, the publisher, super, super exciting. That publisher ended up, before the book had come out, not only leaving the company, but I think the imprint ceased to exist. Maybe they did a structure so there were different imprints. So the book landed with someone who hadn't bought it. I think she was perhaps a more junior person. I think her enthusiasm for the book was, if it existed, was minuscule.
Yeah.
So it sort of reminded me of that, which was not a traumatic experience in any way for me because there was a bonus in a lot of ways, but it was a different experience to what I had expected at the start.
We hear it from so many people, right? And it's because one of the reasons is because the pay in publishing industry is so horrendously shit, there's a lot of movement. And so often the conversations that we have, these ones are off air because this is all commercial and confident stuff, but are from people saying, you know, my acquiring editor left or the public acquiring
editor left.
Which
they're allowed to do.
Of course they are.
Like, it's such a part of life, but not without consequence.
Yeah. And of just that idea that you need, you know, one person to love it and to champion it, which is true. And obviously there are checks and balances. It still has to go through acquisition. So everyone on board has, you know, in the company has agreed. But I think, you know,
I think it's also for me, talks to the idea of luck. Like, you know, there's your book and then there's the gazillion other factors that influence how
Absolutely.
It sells in the world. And you can't have an ego or something that is contingent on sales.
It is luck. It is luck. And, you know, I should say, because I had my acquiring editor left at Simon & Schuster between this last book, Between the Mother Fault and the Hummingbird Effect. But my new editor was entirely on board and actually brought a different kind of thing to it as well. So it can
can work in both ways.
You know, it worked that other way. Wow. I don't know if I'll be listening to that, because what just happened to my anxiety and heart rate while you were telling that story was enough to make me think, I don't know. But I think what you're saying about those different perspectives, even what happens with self-publishing, or sometimes I've had inquiries from people who are not from writing world and they're coming from business world and they want to create a picture book or something to go with that thing, and it's just a lot of money behind them, but it's just a very different approach. Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, full on. Less full on, let's go to our featured book. This episode, our featured book, is brought to you by Text Publishing, and we are so excited to talk to Tara Callaby about her debut novel, House of Longing. Tara Callaby lives in Gippsland with her wife and far too many books. She is currently a PhD student at La Trobe University, researching the social worlds of women in Victorian lunatic asylums. Her speculative and historical short stories have appeared in a number of journals and anthologies. Welcome, Tara.
Thank you very much.
Congrats on the book.
Thank you. Thank you. It's very strange to be on this side of the podcast after listening to so many episodes of other people's books.
I love that. And we are very much on the cusp of things happening, because though we're recording it a couple of days before this episode will come out, your book is actually coming out tomorrow.
Yes. Terrifying and exciting all at the same time.
I completely understand. For listeners, House of Longing is historical fiction. It's set in Melbourne in the 1890s. Tara, you have created such a vivid world in this book. It has so much mood and so much atmosphere. It's so compulsive and readable, and it has a feel, while being very, very different, to Dictionary of Lost Words. Has anyone else mentioned that comparison?
No, actually. Okay. I would have expected it to come before now, given how big that is, but that's an amazing comparison, so I will take it.
It's a fabulous book. When did you know you wanted to write this story, and where did you begin?
Well, initially it was going to be a very, very different book, and I started doing some research for that other book, and I found myself in the Public Records Office of Victoria looking at asylum casebooks of female patients. And in just flicking through those pages, I was struck by how these were people's lives, and they were just compacted down into a few notes about symptoms. And I naturally started wondering what was the rest of these women's stories. And you just can't find that in the records. And I changed my entire PhD topic because of finding these records, and I changed my entire novel because I just wanted to find out more about these female patients, and where there were silences, I wanted to fill those gaps myself if I could.
Oh, that's fascinating. So PhD on one track and then novel writing occurring at the same time?
Yes, it's actually a creative writing PhD. So the novel is part of it, which is great. That means that part of the PhD is done now. And I'm also doing a history critical component as part of it as well. So we'll go into the actual facts of things as well as my own imaginings of them.
Tara, you've mentioned where the idea for the book came from. I know that the novel was written as part of the PhD, but what did the actual writing process look like?
It was sort of really complicated, actually, in a way that I actually started writing a different novel, and my protagonist sort of ran away with me, as they have a habit of doing, and I found quite quickly that what I was actually writing wasn't what I thought I was writing. And so I had a few gaps and breaks, and eventually once it really found itself, it was quite a smooth flow. Of the last 50,000 words or so just came tumbling out once I knew where the book was going And that took a while, as it always does.
Oh, I love that. So the protagonist that you're talking about is Charlotte. She lives in the 1890s. When we meet her, her father owns a stationery shop and she leads a pretty small but contented life. I don't think it's a spoiler to say, because it's on the blurb, there's a bit of a tragedy and she ends up in the Q Lunatic Asylum, supposedly for her own safety. Let's talk about lunatic asylums. I feel like you're going to know a lot about them, but at a really basic level, what was the point of a lunatic asylum?
Well, it really was intended to, at this point in time, keep patients safe from themselves and from, you know, all of the temptations of society for certain types of insanity. There was starting to be an attempt at treatment. It was fairly basic. There were drugs being tried. A lot of it was more things like laxatives than actual useful psychiatric drugs. But
really?
Yes. Yeah, that's a fairly standard thing. You arrive at the asylum, you are given laxatives. And I mean, for some people that seemed to do the job as well. So
really?
Because I think a lot of it is that a lot of the types of illnesses that landed people in asylums in the 19th century were actual physical conditions. There's the more obvious ones like syphilis and things like that that actually cause issues. But for other people, it was that they had had bad fevers and there were delusions that were actually caused by easy medical things to solve. And in those cases, they might only stay in for a week or two. And really, it was just a case of them getting medical treatment that they might not be able to afford outside because the asylums were free.
That's so interesting. That's very different to the popular kind of one flew over the cuckoo's nest view of asylums.
Absolutely. And I think the problem is that asylums were horrible and then they were problematic, but I think well-meaning. And then I think they became quite horrible again. So a lot of what we think of with asylums is actually comes from the 20th century and things like the one flew over the cuckoo's nest and all of those horrible stories of lobotomies and unconsensual shock treatment and things like that, that were quite horrific treatments that were given to patients with no consent and no understanding, and the doctors were really experimenting as well. But in my period, there were absolutely issues of abuse that were going on because we had a lot of untrained attendants that, struggled sometimes with patients who might have been abusive to them as well through their own, you know, mental health conditions. But I think that there genuinely was an element of asylum during that period that I don't necessarily think was as present, maybe even 20, 30 years later. It's a bit of a pity, really. Sometimes I feel like things were better then than they are now in some ways, but in other ways, of course, we are so much better off.
It's interesting you point out the word asylum because I feel like that's the word that's often glossed over in the word lunatic asylum. Lunatic is, I don't know if it's the more evocative one, but it feels like the one that we would debate a little bit more now.
Yeah, and I mean, it's partially that they just had asylums, so they had benevolent asylums as well, which there were several types of large institutions, and it was very much a period of these huge, huge, magnificent buildings where people were all popped inside for various reasons. And initially it was very much a case of hiding people away from society. But as the century progressed, it really did become more of a case of trying to help. And there was far more emphasis on let's try and cure these people. Not only because the asylums were awfully crowded by the end of the century, so they wanted to fix them and move them on, as, you know, it wasn't entirely for their patients' benefit as well as the doctors. So
the period of the 1890s also was not a great time for women having agency over their own lives. The central characters in this book conform in some ways and they don't conform in others. I'm interested in this particular moment in time, what either does or can this idea of nonconformance or pushing back look like?
I think that one of the things I always try to be aware of when writing other periods and other people is that resistance doesn't always have to be active. It can be passive as well. And I think that where there are situations of where somebody is quite powerless compared to greater society, whether it be the patriarchy or it be the upper class versus the lower class sort of divide, I think that sometimes nonconformance can be a fairly quiet, subtle thing that doesn't need to be picket lines shouting for votes or anything like that. It can just be simply, refusing to get married, which was something that a lot of women did that doesn't necessarily get, doesn't, it's not exciting. It doesn't make you, I don't know how to put this, but you know, it's not as interesting as suffrage and things like that, but just the quiet determination to forge your own path, even if that is in just a small way.
Tara, you've done a lot of research as part of this book. I'm really interested in this sense of atmosphere that I mentioned at the start, because it's sort of hard to pinpoint, but it's so striking and so absorbing as a reader. I'm interested in, or how did you go about creating the world that the story was set in?
I think that a lot of it was just by really just throwing myself into that world as much as I could. So I was doing the historical research on one hand, but I was also reading a lot of contemporary fiction. And I don't just mean the big names. I was doing a lot of reading of little short stories on Trove, which is an amazing resource. So the newspapers of the time always had short stories and novel serializations. And so I did a lot of reading of that just to, I guess, feel more present in the time as I was writing. And I think that helped a lot.
I wonder about the language within the contemporary short stories, because, and I mean this as a compliment, your book is very easy to read. The language is really straightforward. Was that true of those short stories?
They're not over the top. They are probably more flowery than the book is. The book was probably more flowery until my brilliant editor got a hold of it, because I think she really helped bring out, I guess, the feel of the period without sliding into pastiche too much, which I think I just have a tendency to do in everyday life. So I think that was helpful to have that second pair of eyes to reel me back in, where it became a little too authentic for the era, which then of course makes it less readable for the modern reader.
That's interesting. And the editor that you are talking about is Mandy Brett, who was also my editor at Text.
Yes, who is amazing. And, I'm just so grateful to get to be part of that author-editor relationship, which is always one of my favourite parts of writing, is that partnership.
It's incredible. So once you had finished The House of Longing, the manuscript, what was the pathway to publication?
Quite unusual. I wasn't actually intending to send it out on submission until I'd finished my PhD, which is not due to happen for another year or so. But I actually got an email from Mandy, who had seen me on Twitter and talking about my research and the fact that I was writing a novel, and asked to see it when it was ready to be sent out. So,
wow, Twitter does good.
That's my key, I think, piece of advice that come out of it, that social media Well, be careful what you're saying on it, but also that it does have its perks and its benefits. And part of it is just being out there in a community of writers and, you know, being able to be seen if somebody just happens to come across a post by you.
Wow, that's a dream email though, right?
Yes, it was. Yeah, I think it probably took me several days and just rereading it and just, you know, not really believing that that was the sort of thing that one receives that as an email. But the manuscript was almost ready at that point. I spent about a month or so just doing the last minute polishing and then sent it off to Mandy. And basically everything happened really quickly from there. I'm not sure exactly the timeline, but I think within a couple of weeks or so, we were getting to the point of talking about contracts.
Wow. This is everything about this is an anomaly.
I know it's all so strange. And I didn't even really consider, saying no, because Text was my dream publisher. So it when things like that happen, they all just seem too easy and too perfect to say no, because it feels a little bit like the world is saying, here it is, take it. And yeah, so I took it very happily.
And it's worked. Tara, we have a lot of listeners to this show that are writers themselves. What is either the best or the worst writing advice you have ever been given?
Oh, I think a lot of the advice I'd been given, I would say, would be the worst advice, simply because I think it just matters so much on an individual person. And it's very hard to have a large, you know, something that actually works for everybody. I think the best advice that I have received and that I would give to everybody else is to submit your work. You cannot get anywhere unless you take that leap and you send things out. And I think that it helps if you send some things out that aren't as precious to you first, so you can get used to rejections that aren't going to actually cut you to the heart. So, you know, send out essays, send out short stories, get used to publishing and having those reviews come in as well as the rejections, and then you start getting acceptances, and that's fantastic. Mm. So, but you can't ever be published if you don't submit your writing.
Mm, that's good advice. Can you recommend a book, fiction, nonfiction, can be from any time, any place, any genre, by a debut author?
Yes. Well, I thought that's such an enormous range. So I thought, well, I'm going to go with the debut book that I most recently read and loved, and that is A Million Things by Emily Spurr, which is another textbook, and I believe it came out last year. And it was, I believe it was presented to me along the lines of everyone cries, you will cry. And I did cry for about the last third, but that's not why I loved it. I am such a fan of intergenerational friendships, and that's what's at the heart of the book. And so it was meant for me in that way, but I think that it just has a lot of heart itself, and I think that it's one that can appeal to a lot of different people.
It's a cracker of a book. It's such a good book. I think Emily Spurr has another book, if not this year, maybe next year, which I am eagerly anticipating.
Yes.
Tara, where can our listeners find you? Twitter, obviously.
Well, I'm pretty much all over the internet. I have a website just at tarakallaby.com. I am on Twitter and Instagram, mostly in terms of social media. And I believe both of those are Tara_Callaby. So you'll find me on Twitter a lot of the time when I'm meant to be writing. So if you see me on there, probably you should just kick me off and tell me to go and do what I'm meant to be doing.
Thank you, Tara Callaby, for being on the show.
Great. Thank you so much.
I'm going to tell you what I've been watching, because I said I've been doing some binging this week, and I am very, very late to this, and I have not yet finished season one. So if you have, don't tell me. I'm watching The Last of Us. Have you watched it?
Oh, no. I thought you were going to say Ted Lasso.
No, anyway. I still haven't done that. I know. So The Last of Us, a bazillion people have recommended this to me. It is a post-apocalyptic drama, beautifully produced. It is based on a video game, which I didn't realise. A virus sweeps the world, and in 3 days, you know, the world has stopped, and things move on in the way that they do in post-apocalyptic kind of dramas. It's got very Station 11 vibes for people who watched that series. The book as well, but, you know, that series was a very particular look and feel, and it's got that. So the production values are just extraordinary, the kind of way they've created these, cities covered in jungle and all the rest of it is just incredible. So beautiful to watch. The kid in it, Ellie, played by Bella Ramsey, is just incredible. Like, so great to watch. But also the storytelling, the creation of it. So like in Station 11, there's some episodes which are flashbacks, but kind of they just sit on their own like a short story. And they're just
cool,
beautiful kind of the passing of time. There's one, it's not a spoiler, with the characters Bill and Frank early on, and it is its own little world, perfect short story or novella in itself. Just beautiful storytelling. And I actually messaged last night when I was watching, I messaged Tegan Bennett Daylight, because the episode I was up to is set in a mall. And you might recall I was raving about Tegan Bennett Daylight's new YA book called Royals, which is set in a mall with a bunch of teenagers. And last night's mall ep was incredible. It's one that I kind of wish in a way that I could watch it with the kids, because this kid character, this teen character is so incredible, but it's just way too scary. You cannot watch this with your kids, or I certainly couldn't. The virus is it Cordyceps? I don't know if that's the way. Did you watch the David Attenborough episode? Do you remember the David Attenborough episode where the ant gets the fungal infection and it grows out of its head?
It's like, oh my God, no.
Guard in my brain from whenever I watched it. That is what happens, like this fungal kind of infection. Anyway, it's incredible. So many people had recommended it to me, and I did that thing of not watching it very purposefully until I was completely done with the book, because I have a kind of a post-apocalyptic section in the book. So it was one of those things where I was like, I cannot be influenced by this. I don't want to see it. I don't want to go, oh my God, I've written the same thing. You know, but it is so good. I highly, highly recommend The Last of Us. And for people who've already watched it, wait till I finish the last couple of episodes, and then let's have a full debrief, because I'm just,
oh my God, it sounds tense. I feel tense now just listening to that.
Yeah. I mean, for me though, less intense than listening to the publishing drama, because that's where my anxiety spikes.
I feel like you like tension though.
I do.
Two that I had to stop because the tension was so enormous was the In-Betweeners, Foreigners. Foreigners that you had recommended. And the other one was Bad Sisters or Bad Sister, Bad Sisters. Oh my God, the tension. I couldn't even. I ended up just reading what happened on Wikipedia.
Watch that till the end.
No. Oh, it's too intense. Just really?
Ah, that is so interesting. Yeah, I am a junkie for tension, I must say, that I quite enjoy that.
I have recently actually started reading ahead in novels to see what happens. So is my current aversion to tension. I just want to know that I can relax.
Wow. I feel like this needs to be an on-air therapy session. New for you?
Probably last couple of years, like a COVID ad. I'll blame it on COVID.
It is because of that extraordinary period of uncertainty and having no idea what was going to happen next. You're like, just give it to me. Give me the ending. How far ahead are you reading?
Oh, I read the end. I'll read just the last chapter. Yeah. Routinely, not even occasionally, like all the time. Yeah.
But then what about the reveal? What about getting to the moment and the reveal and the
still enjoyable. Still enjoyable.
That's
it's so a bit like I know my father-in-law, there was a particular, he goes for Western Bulldogs. There was a particular grand final that he didn't watch but recorded, found out that Western Bulldogs won and now watches it all the time. And there is a time that I would have not understood that. And now I get it. I really get it.
Oh, my dad. Yeah. My dad can't watch the football. He's a Demon supporter. He cannot. He cannot watch. It's quite funny. Leo teasing.
It's hilarious. Okay. My watching is I have been absolutely desperate for the Vanderpump Rules finale. And it has finally come. This is the Scandival centered few episodes that anyone who is in the know has probably just been as desperate as I am. But maybe this is linked to the tension thing. I have seen now so much of it play out in the real world that I'm like both desperate and slightly bored by it.
Okay, so it didn't meet, so this big thing, which I have no idea about.
I've been waiting and waiting and waiting, and then I watched it. It's like I started watching it yesterday. It's the reunion. So they get all the cast members together at the end of the season, and they sort of do a bit of a, Andy Cohen has this very clever, I think, device for interviewing where he sits and he has all of these cards and he'll say, maybe I've said this before, he'll ask like a really harsh question, but he'll say, you know, Kate from Melbourne's asked, like, why did you, you know, insert super harsh questions? So it comes from an audience member, allegedly. It probably does, but clever. Still. But so it is filmed this, I think a week or so after this massive cheating scandal where a couple who have appeared to be stable and together for sort of 10 odd years, the guy and the best friend of his now ex-partner. But there is so much anger in the room that people are kind of unhinged. It hasn't had the arc of if you go from upset to angry, everybody is still in angry. So just people are just yelling things. They're like one guy, James Kennedy, who's a bit odd anyway, is just like yelling across the room, you're a poo-poo face and you're a poo-poo face. Like it just is weirdly emotive. So we'll see how it goes. I think they've, I mean, they've probably milked it for three or four finale episodes, but it's this funny thing for reality TV in which you create a show that is about a reality, but reality TV has such massive followings that you start to see things play out in the real world before they hit the show and kind of an instance of the surprise being spoiled.
Very meta. Wow. Okay.
God, I wish you watched reality.
I know. I know.
Vanderpump.
Yeah. I know. One time I will do this for you. I will, you can give me a list. You can tell me where to begin and I will do it. I will put the time aside. I only have a very quick listening and this is, it's a song, which is very strange for me, but I think I talked about Eliza Hull, who is a Australian musician. She's a writer. She's a disability advocate. She's the editor of We've Got This, Stories by Disabled Parents, which came out a couple of years ago. And I saw her perform at the Mother Gala earlier this year that the Wheeler Centre put on and was just like utterly captivated. I was like, oh, why am I not following this singer and listening to all of her stuff? She was so good. So she's currently on tour in the UK, but she's just released a new single called Running Underwater and it is fabulous. It's a fabulous song. But if you go to, I'll put the link in, and if you go to her Instagram as well, the video clip is extraordinary. It features a dancer who goes by Roya the Destroyer. And I've just been watching on repeat this video. It's very impressive. And Eliza Hull is just one of those people who, you're just like, wow, you are very talented in all the areas and, you know, triple threat. So highly recommend Running Underwater by Eliza Hull.
I've watched
the video clip.
A video clip in like many years.
Yeah, do it. I recommend it. You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to the First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.